You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Brookings. We are very lucky today to have the Danish Minister for Trade and Investment, Pia Olsen Dyhr, who will present today's keynote speech. This will be followed by a panel discussion moderated by Kathy Sierra from Brookings, with Jennifer Hillman, who's a senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund, and Joshua Meltzer, who's a fellow here at Brookings and who works on trade and climate. Denmark hosts the EU presidency right now, and the minister will talk on the European Union vision for promoting trade in ways that support climate change action. She will not talk about the Eurozone crisis and the euro and things like that. We've had enough of that for a while. The link between trade and climate change, of course, are very, very interesting. Legal links, economic links, policy links. I think it's a topic that deserves top priority. Pia Olsen Dyhr has been Denmark's Minister for Trade and Investment since October 2011. She's been a member of the Danish Parliament since 2007. From 2006 to 2007, she was the political coordinator for CARE Denmark. Complementing the minister's current responsibilities, she has had significant environment experience, notably as the international coordinator for the Danish Society for the Conservation of Nature from 2003 to 2006. And she holds a master's in political science from the University of Copenhagen. As you know, Denmark, the last few years, I mean, the whole period has played quite an important role on the whole climate issue. I will hand the moderation over to Catherine Sierra, my dear colleague from Brookings, senior fellow in the Global Economy and Development Program. Kathy focuses on climate change with a particular emphasis on the developing world. Previously, she was the Vice President for Sustainable Development at the World Bank from 2007 to 2010, and then Vice President for Infrastructure from 2004 to 2007. So she's had a long period leading the World Bank's work on both infrastructure and climate issues. She was the bank's spokesperson on climate change, represented it at the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change meetings and at the G8 and G20 on climate and environment issues. She holds degrees from the University of California and Santa Barbara and Harvard. She will introduce the two panelists when the time comes. Mr. Dyhr, the floor is yours.
Good morning, everyone. Ladies and gentlemen, let me start by thanking the Brookings Institute for the invitation to speak here today. It is a privilege to be invited to one of the world's most prominent think tanks. The Brookings Institution has a stated mission to provide innovative and practical recommendations which will secure a more safe, prosperous, cooperative international system. The initiative to host a series of public seminars on green trade shows Brookings is indeed on track with this mission. My main theme today is how we can tailor trade policies to support our objective of combating climate change. We need to work smartly and through all international mechanisms if we are to achieve a cleaner, safer, and more prosperous world community. Today I would like to present a few suggestions. I'm equally interested in views and considerations of my fellow panelists and of the participations in the audience. In the view of the upcoming GU+20 summit, our discussion here today is well-timed. Preparation for RIO+20 is proceeding fast. Green growth is an issue at the heart of my own political agenda, both as the Danish Minister for Trade and Investment, but also as a representative of the current Danish EU presidency. It is a priority for me during the Danish presidency to put green trade liberalisation firmly back on the EU trade agenda. Also, it is an issue where transatlantic cooperation is immensely important. In December, I participated at the 8th WTO Ministerial Conference in Geneva. My impression was clearly, but also unfortunately, that a conclusion of the Doha Development Round is not possible in the immediate future. The same difficulties in achieving progress in the Doha Development Round as a whole have also been evident in the dynamics of the negotiations on environmental goods and services at the WTO. The impasse of the Doha Development Round has forced us to look for new approaches to further trade liberalization at a time where crises around the world make it tempting to turn to protectionism. So for green trade, we must also look for new approaches. But let me first stress that I'm not giving up on the WTO as an institution. We have to move forward on our goal of reaching a multilateral agreement. We must not let our disappointment over the fate of the Doha affect our support of our first priority, a strong and rule-based multilateral trading system which also benefits the developing countries. Green trade liberalization contains two paradoxes. First, while almost all governments agree that trade liberalization in the area of green goods and services is a good thing, almost all governments to some extent distort free trade in green products through subsidies, tariffs, non-tariff barriers such as local content rules. Second, while almost all governments agree that the challenge of climate change is increasingly important, progress in multilateral negotiations to address the issue is very limited. I am committed to look past these paradoxes and to promote green trade liberalization because I do not see any real alternative. If we are to combat climate change efficiently, the global society must find a constructive way forward in green trade liberalization. One should not be naive about the possibilities. Behind the paradoxes are economic and industrial interests among the world's biggest economic players. A fierce competition is going on to become world leader in sustainable production. What some has called the race to the top, shaping the energy framework to a world much less dependent on fossil fuels, has already begun. On the other hand, it is worthwhile to recall the words of the President Franklin D. Roosevelt, who once said, "Competition has shown to be useful up to a certain point and no further, but cooperation, which is the thing we must strive for today, begins where competition leaves off." These clever words have stood the test of history. The global community does need to look past competition and strive for cooperation. The window of opportunity has come, and it is too important to be missed. It is in the interest of every nation to do so. The key question is, how do we promote international cooperation in green trade in practice? I do not yet have the full answer to this question, but I have two suggestions as to where we start. First, green trade liberalization should be high on the agenda for all governments, including in bilateral free trade agreements. Secondly, possibilities for new approaches at the WTO should be examined with an open mind. On my first point, green growth is the overall priority of the Danish EU presidency. In the area of trade policy, it is my ambition to put green trade firmly on the EU agenda again. When EU trade ministers met in March this year, the European Commission was asked to prepare an option paper for our next meeting, which will take place on the 31st of May. On this basis, EU trade minister will discuss possible ways forward in green trade, including with the US. The EU must have a strong green component in every free trade agreement made with partners around the world. In particular with the US, such a component could have a significant bearing on sustainability and job creation in our two economies. By putting green trade liberalization high on their agendas, government will pave the way for green FTA stepping stones, pointing to a later agreement at the multilateral level. This goes for the EU and the US, as well as all other countries. This leads me to my second point concerning the World Trade Organization. The changing overall political framework condition in trade policy and the need for fresh approaches at the WTO. There is now an even stronger push towards bilateral or regional solutions than before the 8th WTO ministerial conference in Geneva in December last year. This is not necessarily bad. However, our efforts to negotiate a multilateral agreement at the WTO should not be given up. Past experience has shown tremendous challenges with the two paradoxes I just mentioned. Still, it's worthwhile to take a fresh look at things in Geneva. Let me give you one example why. So far, it's been very difficult to engage China in negotiations about green trade liberalization. China has viewed the issue as domestic industrial policy, not trade. However, this view is slowly changing, partly because China is increasingly exporting green goods like windmills and solar panels, and therefore has an increasing interest in green trade. And partly because China too needs international cooperation in order to combat environmental challenges nationally. And yes, I am fully aware that some are questioning whether Chinese exports in green products are truly reflecting market-based prices. Let us not forget that what was not possible to discuss at the WTO meeting 6 months ago is now being discussed, heeding the call of General Secretary Pascal Lamy from the 8th WTO ministerial conference for new and innovative negotiations approaches to be explored. The most obvious example is, of course, the recent US initiative on the service plurilateral agreement. I fully share the hope of Mark Linscott, the assisting US trade representative, who, when he spoke here at Brookings on March 20th, pointed to significant prospects for bringing to the table a constructive discussion of trade and environmental issues. As an example of the new approach, let me bring to your attention a specific proposal put forward by the Geneva-based think tank, International Center for Trade and Sustainable Development, the ICTSD. It concerns the ambitious proposal for a sustainable energy trade agreement, the so-called CETA, put forward in autumn last year. CETA is a way to bring trade liberalization in climate-friendly goods and services back on the agenda. CETA is a plurilateral approach on green trade liberalization, proposing to focus on renewable energy and barriers related to that. CETA is innovative, and it is a pertinent dossier for politicians to examine further. I support such new thinking, which could help overcome past differences and break new grounds. I'm not saying that we necessarily have to call it CETA. The most important thing is that we agree on a broader framework which is not only for Europeans, but most importantly, also include the developing countries. For those reasons, I've been highlighting the merits of CETAs in meetings with colleagues from both developed and developing countries, and I've done so during my talks with the Obama administration here in Washington. Ladies and gentlemen, time is ripe for examining all options to liberalize trade in environment and climate-friendly goods and services. These options should include a commitment to transparency in and discussion of bilateral and regional green initiatives. I've noted the commitment from the APEC summit last year to cut green tariffs to 5% by 2015 and to introduce a ban on local content requirements. Equally interesting ideas have been discussed in the Trans-Pacific Partnerships. From an EU perspective, it is of vital importance that any such plurilateral initiative is taken in full transparency and with due respect for non-discriminatory clauses enshrined in GATT and GATS. One key challenge is to get a critical mass of countries offering reciprocal market openings in order for plurilateral agreements such as CETA to attract enough interest. The critical mass should include the OECD countries and most of the emerging economies. If emerging economies are not in, there will not be enough to be gained for the developing countries. CETA and other plurilateral options contain the same inherent conflict as we've seen in the Doha development round, where emerging economies are reluctant to move forward in green trade. We have to make an agreement where the emerging economies will benefit from green trade liberalization. It is crucial, and we cannot afford to shy away from that goal. Talking about high ambitions, I would like to share with you that Denmark sees the threat of climate change as a real crisis. We are also convinced that it's more expensive to respond after the crisis hits rather than preparing for and anticipating the crisis. Denmark has therefore passed a bill to make us carbon-free society by 2050. We aim to reduce greenhouse gases by 40% in 2020, in 8 years. To achieve this goal, the Danish government supports the wind industry by setting up ambitious goals for wind power in Denmark. We have a vision of doubling our power supply from wind in the next 8 years from 25% to 50%. Let me finally make a pitch for the importance of deepening the broader transatlantic economic relationship. I am encouraged by the recent talk on exploring the possibilities of a deep and comprehensive transatlantic trade agreement. One reason is, also in this regard, a deadlock we have encountered in the Doha development round. The trade and investment relationship between the EU and US is by far the strongest and the biggest in the world. We have already a strong foundation. If the EU and US should agree to eliminate tariffs and non-tariff barriers, the gains would be huge on both sides of the Atlantic. Recent studies indicate that it would have a significant impact in terms of growth and jobs for both sides. There is now a window of opportunity. Dialogues between negotiators has intensified in the high-level working group created last autumn, and progress has been made. Now is the time to be bold on both sides of the Atlantic. A comprehensive approach should be sufficiently large so it sparks to truly job-creating outcome. Strengthening transatlantic cooperation today is one part of a larger exercise, which includes all areas of EU-US trade and investment relations, the green area being one of the most important. Let me stress that an agreement between the EU and US should not be a replacement for a broader multilateral trade framework that also includes developing countries. Rather, I see the launching of an EU-US negotiation as an icebreaker for a new momentum in the multilateral negotiations. I look forward to your questions and ideas on how the EU and the US, both business and governments, can work together in promoting this agenda, both in view of a larger transatlantic relationship and more specifically with regards to the green area, which is so important to confront in rising challenges stemming from climate change. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister, for bringing to us the perspective of the EU and Denmark on what I think we all agree is a very important part of the green development and climate change agenda. As you said in your remarks, we here at Brookings are examining many parts of the climate change and green growth agenda through different lenses. Trade is one in anticipation of RIA Plus 20, but also to try to push some momentum on these issues. And I think that your presentation is one of those markers. So I want to thank you very much for being here. What we're going to do now is to introduce two of our panelists who will make some commentary and remarks on the minister's presentation, as well as provide their own thoughts on how the trade agenda, and in particular the trade US-EU agenda, can support both job creation as well as a move to a cleaner and more healthy world and in combating climate change in particular. I'd like to introduce to my far right is Josh Meltzer. He's a fellow here at the Global Economy and Development Program at Brookings. Prior to joining Brookings in 2010, Josh was first secretary for trade policy at the Australian Embassy here in Washington. He's also worked at the Office of Trade Negotiations and the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, where he was a trade negotiator for Australia's free trade negotiations with Malaysia and the ASEAN and New Zealand. He holds degrees from the University of Melbourne, Australia, as well as advanced degrees from the University of Michigan Law School in Ann Arbor. His left is, I'm very happy to have on this panel, Jennifer Hillman. Jennifer joined the German Marshall Fund as a transatlantic fellow in February 2008. In December 2007, she became one of the first of the seven members of the WTO's appellate body, the final adjudicator on international trade disputes. She previously worked for the U.S. International Trade Commission from 1998 to 2007, and prior to that, from 2002 to 2004, served as the vice chairman of the commission. She's also served as general counsel in the Office of the U.S. Trade Representatives in the 1990s. Holds a degree from the Harvard Law School, as well as master's and undergraduate degrees from Duke University. I think they're both very well qualified to give their perspectives. So I'm going to first ask Josh to walk us through your thoughts in terms of how the EU-US trade and investment can be pushed to be able to meet some of the climate objectives. Josh.
Thanks. And I just want to say thank you, Minister, for what was certainly a very interesting and comprehensive overview of the trade and climate change intersection, and giving us a view on the EU position on these issues. Certainly thinking about the intersection between international trade and climate change has been a focus of quite a bit of the work that we've been doing here at Brookings, and certainly will continue to be going forward, and so we very much welcome your attention to this issue. I guess the brief comments I want to make today are to talk a little bit about the investment side of the trade and the broad economic issues that come up when we think about ways that we can develop international economic policy in a way that can support climate change action in other countries. And in this regard, I want to think a little bit more about the relationship that the EU has with China in particular. You mentioned China briefly in your speech, and obviously a very significant economy, and obviously doing a lot of very important work in the green energy and the green technology space. And it certainly seems to me that when we think about the EU relationship with China, and it's certainly true of the US relationship as well, but I'll focus my comments on the EU, is that the investment side of the relationship is significantly underdone. There's an enormous trading relationship that the EU has with China. I understand last year it was in the range of €420-430 billion, and the investment relationship in comparison was in the magnitude of about $9 billion. And that is, as I understand it, the lowest level of investment from any of the BRIC countries into the EU. In fact, it's something like a factor of 10 compared to, say, Brazilian investment in the EU. And I guess I point this out simply to make the point that there seems to be enormous opportunity for growth in developing the investment relationship between the EU and China, in particular when we look at Chinese investment in the EU. And so when I think about what that means in terms of green technology and green energy, it seems to me that one of the obvious benefits that would flow from this, and I guess this conversation today is being somewhat framed in the context of the EU crisis and what's going on there, is that that has certainly led at some level to a shortage of available capital for investment purposes in the EU, and obviously increasing opportunities for flows of investment from other countries, China being one of them, would provide funding and opportunities for further investment into the renewable energy, green technology space, which would obviously be significantly beneficial for the EU in terms of its ability to pursue its ambitious climate change agenda, and would obviously have significant inputs and benefits in terms of economic growth and jobs. The other obviously part of that relationship would be to give China an opportunity to invest in what is obviously a very mature and very sophisticated market in the EU in the green technology, green energy space. And that would then, in its own way, be a learning opportunity to provide an opportunity for Chinese businesses to learn about, you know, world's best practices in some of these areas. And this in itself can be somewhat of a conduit which can then, where all this learning and experience can also be applied back in China and help their efforts to do more in that space. So I guess this would be a classic win-win situation. So I guess I just want to raise that as one issue which I think is important to also focus some attention on. Again, I welcome you and thank you very much for your comments and attention to this issue.
Thank you very much, Jennifer.
Well, thank you. And I would like to also congratulate Minister Deer on both the very comprehensive comments and to say that coming from a trade perspective, I would certainly share an awful lot of your impressions that, if you will, the failure of Doha and to some degree the failure in the climate change world to reach sort of binding global comprehensive agreements, out of that, I think, has come a real change in attitudes in terms of what can be done and a willingness to think about new approaches. And I throw out sort of three areas that I think would be worth some discussion or some thinking about. The first might be in the bilateral area. And I start with the bilateral area because I completely agree with you, Minister, that this is the area in which I see the most change in attitude. For the longest time, those of us that have looked at trade issues have always been, when the minute you say that there should be an agreement between the United States and the European Union, the response is always, you can't do that because it will undermine the multilateral agenda. It will ruin Doha. You cannot go there in terms of a relationship, a direct agreement between the United States and Europe. And that has completely changed. I would say literally 180-degree change, where both on the part of the United States and most importantly from the U.S. perspective on the part of Europe, there has been a complete willingness to think about a broad, comprehensive agreement between the U.S. and Europe in a way that we've never seen before. And I would agree with you that I think there is a window open now to think about doing that kind of an agreement. And when you think about that in the green space area, I would argue two items that you would put, I would argue, on the top of the agenda to the extent that you're focusing on it. One is the one that you mentioned very clearly, which is among the United States and Europe, one would think you could quickly agree upon a list of environmental goods and services where you could start your negotiations with let's liberalize those first. Let's immediately agree these things should come duty-free and free of barriers between the U.S. and Europe. The second thing that I would put on the agenda is to resolve what I worry may become a dispute, which is the issue of aviation emissions, where the European Union has put emissions from aircraft on the emissions trading system, which has created difficulties on the U.S. side. And again, that is something that ought to be solved bilaterally, ought to be solved quickly, so that it does not become yet another one of these potentials for a clash between the climate change world and the trade world. So I do think there is huge opportunity to move on the bilateral side. On the plurilateral side, I would completely agree with you, Minister, that you are absolutely right, that what the United States and Europe can and ought to be doing is coming to an agreement among themselves and then inviting the coalition of the willing, getting to that critical mass in order to then end up with a comprehensive agreement. Comprehensive meaning it covers enough that you have covered substantially all of the trade in that area. And again, I would throw out as sort of starting places in this world of creating green space, the idea that has been promoted for some time by some folks here in Washington, which is to create a peace clause around any disputes over any conflicts between climate change and trade issues, or you would simply agree that if a measure, whatever it might be, a tariff, a subsidy, a cap and trade, a carbon tax, whatever it might be, if it falls within the clear parameters of being directly related to the reduction of greenhouse gases, that it simply will not be the subject of a WTO dispute. I mean, even if it might technically violate some provision of the WTO agreement, you agree in advance that you simply are not going to bring challenges in that area, so that there is a green space in which trade policy and climate change policy don't have to war with each other. Secondly, to me, you would put on a plurilateral agreement the idea of renewing what had been in place between 1995 and 2000, which is the idea that subsidies that are granted for research and development in technology that is going to lead to to the implementation of environmental agreements or to development of technology that will help on the greenhouse emission side would not be subject to subsidies disciplines. That this would be carved out as what would be referred to in trade parlance as a green light area. And I would say the third thing that the U.S. and the EU could do together would be to figure out a way to create a mechanism that promotes and highlights best practices and subjects them to peer review. For example, in the WTO, I think one of the sort of unheralded successes of the WTO has been the trade policy review mechanism, which many have put down because it isn't binding. It doesn't lead directly into disputes. But it is a tremendous mechanism by which countries get together and examine the trade policies, all of the trade policies of a given country on a schedule. So you know every 4 years, every 2 years, every 6 years, your policies are going to come under your peers' microscope. It has promoted tremendous transparency. I mean, you have to actually come forward and disclose any laws, rules, regulations connected to your trade policy. But to me, more importantly, what that mechanism has done has encouraged countries to behave, I mean, to change their policies up front. Particularly, I would say this is important for the developing countries. I mean, if you look at what's happened in Geneva, there's an organization called the Advisory Center on WTO Law, created as a legal services center, if you will, to provide help to developing countries if they should be in a dispute, so they've got a free lawyer there to help them. What's turned out is 80% of their work is advising developing countries on what laws to pass or what laws not to pass in order to be consistent with their WTO obligations. If you could create that kind of a mechanism so that you're encouraging countries up front what policies to adopt or not to adopt to help on the climate change front, and you learn from your peers through a peer review mechanism, to me, you would be doing a lot to help on the climate change agenda. I mean, clearly, a lot is happening in the U.S. I mean, if you look at emissions, I mean, we're projected to be down 7.5% below 2005 levels. I don't think very many people out there would know that the United States is, in fact, so precipitously down in emissions levels. And again, some sort of peer examination of how did that come about? I mean, what has the United States done to achieve that that could be shared with others would mean some things that we could do sort of now and without a broad multilateral agreement that would nonetheless move the conversation a long way. And those would be sort of initial.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. So now I'm going to ask the minister to respond a bit. And you've heard, I think, agreement with your broad framing of the issues as well as the type of recommendations you have, particularly with respect to an agreement between the EU and the United States, with some very specific recommendations from Jennifer with respect to agreeing very quickly on a list of environmental goods and services, but more interestingly, also resolving the aviation dispute, as well as moving that into a plurilateral position, inviting others in. Do you think that's doable? It's doable in what type of time frame, Minister?
I think I would like to elaborate also a bit about what Jess was saying. If I should start with Jennifer and moving ahead the bilateral EU-US, I think it depends on the ambition level. Because, first of all, the EU ministers, and we had a meeting in March where we had an informal discussion on EU-US, it was pretty clear to me that they want a comprehensive and deep negotiation. And I think calling still, somebody would call a free trade agreement, I think we need to use new language, because this was actually how can we generate growth and jobs in Europe and in US. I think that would be the right way of perceiving this, because this is actually what it's about. And coming to that, it depends on G8, the meeting in Camp David, where Barroso will be discussing this with Obama, because I'm interested in, and maybe I could also get your perspective on that, where is the U.S. really at the moment? could it be a comprehensive deemed commitment? I've heard the administration being saying that, but then how do we move forward in this? Do we have short-term goals? Do we have the whole package, single undertaking? How do we understand that? And I think I agree with what you were saying, Jennifer, that in the green goods, it would be obvious to move forward if we could get something rolling in that area. I don't think it's going to be that easy, as you probably, I thought you were saying a bit that it would be easy, but I don't agree. But it's going to be difficult, but I think it's an obvious place to start because actually the Americans, as I see it, is very much in need of technology in, for example, water, the area of water. And if we talk about environmental goods, water scarcity in the U.S. is racing, and we actually have some of the answers to this. If we're talking more narrowly about sustainable energy, it is obvious that we mutually can actually benefit from this. U.S. is actually, at the moment, producing quite a lot of solar panels, which is of interest of the Europeans, and Europeans are pushing in wind energy. And I think we can both neutrally benefit from that. Coming to aviation or ETS, I think it's... I think it's not that easy solved, if I should be frank. Because coming from the European side, it's very important for us to use all kind of measures to address the challenge of climate change. And we have had the discussion in international organizations for many years how to set targets on aviation, how to set targets in the area of shipping. And we still see the reluctance to move to international commitments in those two areas. We had the COP meeting, COP15, held in Copenhagen. This was also on the table. We couldn't make decision on this. I think it's important to maybe tell that the ETS in Europe is actually not saying anything about other countries. We are saying every plane landing in Europe has to commit to the ETS system, which means that it will be equal for all companies landing and flying around Europe. It's not going to be something special for Europe or special for other companies. It's a non-discriminatory measure we have put in place. And we have done it with a clear purpose of reducing CO2 emissions from aviation. I had a talk, and I've had a talk with the Chinese, the Russian, and the Americans about ETS. It's not going to be easy solvable, and I'm not seeing any kind of solution. I heard that, well, we can do it in international, in ICAO when we're talking about aviation, but then we have to see something move it forward, because the Europeans is not going to take this off the table before we see movement in international organizations, just to be clear on that. When it comes to EU-China, and Josh's interventions, I just want to say that I know that the investment going from China to the European Union is low, but it's going there. And I've been meeting twice with the Chinese trade minister, Sheng Demeng, and he, last I talked to him, he said there's a clear ambition from the Chinese to go global. It's now going to be a strategy from China. And going global also means viewing Europe. And I have noticed there is a growing interest from the Chinese going to Europe. I think we can both benefit from that. We have a very small company, a wind turbine company in Silkeborg, a small city in Denmark, where the Chinese has bought up a company which were going broke. And this is kind of a success story because we still have the jobs in Silkeborg in Denmark, but we are together actually developing also technologies from the Chinese, but also developing the company in Denmark, and it's growing. So I think it's a win-win situation. I think somebody might be very hesitant about Chinese investment, being a bit scared that it means that they're buying up Europe. I've seen I think it was the headline of The Economist saying that. But I think we can benefit from it if we're doing it cleverly. Denmark has just opened a national center for renewable energy in Beijing, together with the Chinese authorities, because we've been very focused on China has now in their five-year plan an ambition on how to develop standards in China on renewable energy, both in standards, regulations, tariffs, and all that. And the Danish government, because we have a long tradition back to the 70s, on how to develop this. We are now committed with the Chinese to say how can they develop their system, which I think would make it more transparent what the Chinese market is all about. So I think also not only companies but also governments has to go into actions with the Chinese governments to ensure that we have a transparent market. Now I can see he looks at his watch, so I have to stop.
Ah, not at all, not at all. Excellent. Don't pay attention to him, pay attention to me. Let's stay on China for a minute. We heard a vision this morning from the minister, echoed by Jennifer, and I know Josh didn't speak on this, but would likely agree that we don't have high hopes on the WTO Doha round to move these things forward, and so people are looking towards bilateral and plurilateral agreements. And sketched out the thought that perhaps a transatlantic agreement could then get widened, bring in coalitions of the willing, and Jennifer outlined some of the areas that that might include. The question I have is, well, how does this incentivize China to come in? I mean, is this really going to take us there? And I think those of us that focus on climate change see China as an engine of greenhouse gas emissions, as well as an engine of innovation and lowering costs. And so I would think we would have a stake in having a strong agreement, either bottom-up through plurilateral or through a broader agreement. How do these two things collide? Maybe ask Josh, just give him a chance to comment on whether or not this is a strategy that's going to be a winner for that.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy. I might build, actually, that question into, I think, a distinction which has not been probably elucidated so far in the conversation, but I think has certainly been then in the background between if you do go down a plurilateral route, to what extent you do it on an MFN or a non-MFN basis. And I get the impression, Minister, that to the extent that you've been referring to critical mass, that your vision is to do a plurilateral agreement which gets enough countries on board that you avoid sort of the free rider issue and you do it on an MFN basis. And I certainly understand that in the discussions that have been going on around a services plurilateral under the WTO, that the EU position has been that they would like this to be on an MFN basis. And as I'm sure you well know, the US position, at least on the services front, has been quite opposite. It has been that this should really be the benefits of the agreement should be kept amongst the parties to the agreement. It should be not extended on an MFN basis. So I guess this then sort of segues back to your question, Kathy, which is what are the prospects if you do a plurilateral agreement for getting a critical mass in at the beginning and particularly getting China in and therefore maybe getting up to enough countries in terms of trade in green goods and services that you are in that critical mass world and you can do it on an MFN basis, or is that unrealistic, and are we in a place where we're going to have a smaller group of countries moving first, and then we really need to ask the hard question of do we keep the benefits to those countries only, and then basically the lack of the MFN is partly the incentive really to get the other countries to sign on down the track.
Jennifer.
Well, I mean, obviously, I think you raise very good points. I mean, with respect to China, I do think there is some movement in terms of where they stand both on the climate change side and on the trade side. I mean, many people would ascribe part of the failure of Doha is that the Doha negotiations from the very get-go, in essence, divided the entire world into two camps, the developed and the developing. And because China was part of the developing world, as was India and Brazil and a number of other major emerging partners, and over the 10-year life of the negotiations of the Doha round, China obviously massively changed a sort of where it sat in terms of, and yet it did not change with who it was holding its caucuses, and it consistently caucused, if you will, with the developing and particularly the least developed countries, and continued to insist that it receive the special and differential and all of the various other things that one gets in the trading world if you are a really developing country. And there never was a process by which you could say, well, now, fine, but really that's not how the world looks. It's not two camps. There are still least developed countries that need certain things, but certainly the Chinas and the Indias and the Brazils of the world need to be caucusing, if you will, closer to the developed world than not. And I would say even in the climate world, you've at least seen in Durban, China and India, agree that they will be bound by whatever is the ultimate agreement that comes out in 2020, which is at least movement, instead of saying that we're going to remain in the least. So in that sense, I think there's hope that China recognizes that it cannot stay in the place that it had been when these agreements started. That doesn't get you to sort of how do you resolve these agreements. My own view is I think we're at a point where Doha is not going to go anywhere, and therefore I think you need to do what is doable. I mean, what I don't think the world can do is wait another 10 years for the right coalition, the right moment, the right time, the right trading partners. My own view would be, and I think I'm saying what the minister has said again, is I personally think you could do a very deep, broad U.S.-EU agreement that would clearly make China, India, and Brazil sit up and take notice about whether they wanted to be left out of that kind of a partnership. It would at least allow things like standards to be set at a high level, standards on everything from government procurement to corruption to everything else, where the U.S. and the EU could agree to a very high level of standard, and China's going to have to make some very difficult decisions about whether it's prepared to be left out of that equation. But to me, that is still a better world than allowing China to be setting the standards by not entering into these kind of agreements.
Minister, any comments on that before we turn to the audience?
I think the difficult part is that even, I agree very much with Jennifer, there's still the part about the developing countries, because there is this paradox if EU-US move forward, and I think we are at a point where there's no return, we have to move forward. It still sends a signal in some way that the developing countries are left by themselves, because if you view the WTO, the World Development Agenda, and see the economic calculation who will benefit from this, it will be the global community in general, but also developing countries. A US-EU trade agreement, who would benefit from that? That would be a narrowing to US and EU, and I think we have to find some way of doing this cleverly so we don't push the developing countries away from us, but actually showing that this could be a way forward. So we have to balance on two legs at the same time, but that's also possible. I think about China, I must say that the world is different from 2001 when we started the discussion in the WTO about environmental goods. I participated back then as an NGO, and I noted the discussion back then was actually this is the developed countries way in to the developing countries' markets in environmental goods. The list is very much focused on goods and services produced in the developed countries. Now the agenda has actually shifted, and I think one should be very clear that in 2012, the producers of renewable energy is no longer just developed countries. It is countries like India, it's countries like China, but it's also South Africa and Kenya who's producing renewable energy. So that's why I think there is a momentum of having this discussion in plurilateral circles, because they would also have an interest in getting on board. If I view you very narrowly China, they have an interest in, for example, the dispute going on with US at the moment on solar panels. They have an interest in that area. They have an interest in reducing subsidies in some areas where they see they have subsidies, but they also see others having subsidies in coal and oil. So if we could address that question, they would have an advantage of it. Of course, it will be not in their advantage having a discussion on export restrictions, for example, on rare earths. But we have to have that discussion globally, because we have a monopoly at the moment with China sitting on the, I think it's 95% of the access to rare earths, and everybody is dependent on it. Just sit with your mobile phone, you know that you cannot, I'm guessing everybody in the room has a mobile phone and cannot live without it, and it actually consists of rare earths. So we have to open this discussion. It's not just about trade, it's also about access to resources in the future. And I see that China has some defensive interest, but they also have some offensive interest. So if we can balance this the right way, and I've noticed when I have talks with Xi Jinping, and they're very candid. I'm a Dane and he's a Chinese, so it's actually possible to have a very frank discussion. and he is interested in this, if it's done the right way. And I think we have to have China on board from the beginning, because if the US and EU is talking about this, then they will feel that we are, well, trying to sidetrack them when we talk about environmental goods and services and also sustainable energy. But I think they could actually be pushed to the table, and I just hope that the U.S. also can be that. And finally, I agree very much what you're saying, Jennifer. If the EU and U.S. go into these talk about a comprehensive and deep agreement, we can set the world standard. And in, for example, in some of these areas where we're talking about RPRs, human rights, all these areas, it would be beneficial globally that we could set a high standard. But if we don't, I just have an open question. Who will then set the standard?
Thank you. Let's now turn to the audience. We have time for questions and answers to any of the panelists. I'm going to ask you, after I call on you, to please identify yourself and direct your question either to the whole panel or to an individual panelist. I had a first question here, and a mic will be coming.
Hi, Lisa Alejandro from the International Trade Commission. We miss you, Jennifer. I'm curious, how do you see the Rio talks influencing multilateral efforts, given that there will be a focus on liberalizing trade in green goods and services?
Thank you. We're going to take a couple of questions, and then we'll direct them here in the front. Thank you. And then
thank you. I'm Margaret Ryan with AOL Energy, and I wondered if you could comment on the effect on trade and on the issues you're looking at of the reduction in subsidies, particularly for the solar industry, that have been experienced in multiple countries in Europe. You have companies there who say they are going out of business. Why would that encourage trade? I mean, it seems to me that it changes the entire picture from the European side, and perhaps you could comment on how that fits in. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nancy.
Hi, I'm Nancy Alexander with the Heinrich Böll Foundation. Thank you for your great presentations. I was interested in your advocacy of CETA and the fact that there's a convergence of a lot of interest around such an agreement. The Green Growth Task Force of the Business 20 just advocated CETA to President Calderon at the G20 meeting in Puerto Vallarta. And I'm wondering if you could do two things. One is say a word about what CETA is in terms of its scope. And number two, you really expressed a great sentiment about how to craft agreements without pushing away the lower income countries. And it would be very helpful to hear your ideas about the kinds of incentives that might interest low-income countries in being part of something like CETA.
Thank you. I think three great questions. I'm going to ask the minister first, as our guest, to take these up, and then perhaps afterwards I can also ask Josh to comment on any of them, but particularly how you see Rio developing itself, and perhaps Jennifer on the question of the crowding in of low-income countries as well. But minister.
Well, I'm still thinking I should be frank about Rio Plus 20, or I should be optimistic, because actually I'm a huge supporter of international working system on sustainable solutions, and that's actually what Rio started off in back in '92 to Johannesburg, and now to Rio Plus 20. But I've seen what's in the Rio Plus 20, and it's not being precise enough, as I would say. It's growing and growing and growing, the text for the meeting in Brazil, and I'm a little concerned that if we don't narrow the scope a bit, that we will miss the opportunity of addressing the real challenges we have globally. And I would say that having I've had talks with, actually, this morning, our environmental minister, who's just arrived in New York, where she's going into talks about this. I think it's important that we address the global challenges we have in the environmental field, coming from resources, resources and waste, energy and climate, water, and biodiversity. If we don't find measurable, tangible measures in these fields, it's going to be another talk, and that is very much my concern. And I hope that the global leaders will commit themselves to make results in Rio. And if it could include, if it could conclude something on trade and sustainable solutions, I would very much commend that. That would be a huge interest of ours. But I've been for Johannesburg in 2002, and I was committed in the negotiations for Rio in 92. So I want to see it before I actually believe it. But I will be optimistic, and I will be cheering also. About reducing subsidies to the solar. Well, in general, in Europe, we believe that the renewable energy sector has to be sustainable in itself. But that also means that we have to use subsidies for coal and oil, because at the moment, we see still, if we view globally, we have the highest subsidies in coal, and then we don't have an equal competitions with the renewable energy sources. But in Denmark, I find that wind energy should be competitive in itself. So, and it is, if you view it in a long term, because we know that the prices of oil is going up and the prices of coal will also go up, even though some places around the world, they haven't realized that yet. But we have actually in my country, and therefore we'd also view renewable energies in another way. I don't think subsidy is the right way of doing this, because then you end up having subsidized everything, and instead of removing subsidy, that would be the right way of doing this, as I see it. About CETA and the G20, as I've noticed them also being in favor of this, that's very good. I think we're a lot of different levels trying to promote this initiative. Coming to the scope of it, it's trying to address both the discussion on subsidies. It's going to address the discussion of export restrictions. It has to address technology transfer, and that is actually the answer to your second question, saying how can we get the developing countries on board. They will be very interested in the dimension of transfer of technology, and I know that we have that discussion in Rio and in Johannesburg and in Rio Plus 20, and I know that we had the discussion in the COP 15 in Copenhagen. But I actually think if you narrow it down to sustainable energy, that is actually feasible. And then we also have to address tariff and non-tariff barriers. So that would be the scope. But how to proceed this? I'm very open. I just need that we actually tackle these five issues.
Josh.
I'm going to have the luxury of not being practical when I think about Rio Plus 20 and to engage in some optimism. One of the key focuses of Rio Plus 20 is this idea of green growth, which is sort of picking up on the environmental and the economic strands of the sustainable development package to talk about ways that you can grow your economy that is sustainably from an environmental perspective. And some of the ideas that are thrown out there, which have been out there for a while, things like, you know, obviously internalizing the costs, the environmental cost of production, which leads to more efficient use of resources, better economic growth, and the like. Since Rio, you know, in 1992, there was some principles that were developed there which looked at the role of trade in that space. And and we've now come a long way since then, and I think that, as the Minister said, one of the key components when you think about sustainability, particularly in the context of climate change, you can't get away from the international economic dimension to it. It's a global environmental problem, and any response to it has got international economic ramifications. So by that very nature of the problem, you bring in a trade and investment dimension. So Rio Plus 20 in an optimistic world would try to have at least a discussion around these issues, possibly even trying to build some principles or frame the issue in a particular way which can set a work program for governments to think about these issues going forward. I just want to pick up very quickly, Cathy, on the subsidies question, because I just want to expand it out a little bit beyond the EU, because I think that certainly when you think about the role of trade in the climate change space, in particular when you think about the role of reducing tariff and non-tariff barriers to environmental goods and services, however you define that, this is a supply-driven
idea in the sense that what you also, obviously the other key component to this is you need climate change policy to actually drive the demand for these environmental goods and services. And so policy uncertainty, wherever it exists, in a sense, is something that needs to be resolved as a necessary complement to actually giving trade an important role. And so I think that the subsidies issue in EU is a real one, but I think around the world the lack of sort of policy certainty on the climate change front is certainly one thing that's hindering the sort of the investment that you need, which will then drive the trade in these goods.
Jennifer,
I would want to make sure that I'm clear that in terms of, I think it would be preferable on the point of not pushing other countries away. I don't think there's any doubt, and I certainly would not want to be viewed as saying that it is preferable, far preferable, to have a multilateral, global, plurilateral agreement than any bilateral agreement. So to the extent that I have touched on this idea of a US-EU agreement, it's more in the absence of moving forward on Doha, but certainly it is far preferable. But if you think about the trade issues really from the developing, and particularly I would say the more least developing, the truly poorer countries, I mean, their concerns are exactly the ones that the minister has described. I mean, they cannot afford to be hurt by not being the subject, not getting the advantage of an MFN tariff preference. So, I mean, whatever one does, one would have to end up with, and whether that's through a generalized system of preferences or some other mechanism, ensuring that whatever agreement you negotiate doesn't leave the developed, truly the developing and particularly the least developing countries with a higher tariff burden than they would otherwise have. So, I mean, you would have to figure out some mechanism. And the other thing that's very detrimental to the least developed countries is subsidies. I mean, to the extent that we and Europe are subsidizing something and they are having to, in that sense, compete with subsidies, I mean, that's what also creates the tremendous difficulties for the least developed countries. So those issues would have to be sorted out in any kind of an agreement in order for there not to be a pushing away of particularly the least developed countries. So those issues, in whatever configuration you would address them, would have to be addressed. Otherwise, I think you would run the risk of really, I mean, both economically and rhetorically and politically pushing away the least developed in a way that would be highly undesirable. So I would certainly agree that you would have to take that into account in any agreement.
Thank you. Let's take another second round of questions. Yes.
I'm Jane Siegel with the Department of Commerce. I wanted to ask follow-up, actually it's almost a follow-up question on the issue of subsidies. I'm speaking with some utilities recently. Many of them, one in particular, says that it's a surprise that natural gas prices are going down. And there is an anticipation that they will continue to go down, which is a big challenge for developing renewable energy and for energy, the energy efficiency portfolio, too, I would think. So the question is, how do we in the United States, those of us in favor of development of renewable energy, look at that kind of conflict with developing countries and others? We need the subsidies, I think, for a while to push the renewable energy portfolio forward.
Thank you. Another question? Yes, here.
Thank you, Minister. I'm Michael Stanton with General Electric. I have a question, which is, you discussed the EU-Canada trade agreement. Is there an environmental goods chapter in that agreement? And if there is, what does that look like? And then my other question is that you also discussed APEC's commitment to reducing tariffs on environmental goods. And they're working rapidly on developing a list, building off the WTO 153. Is there a concern that the EU is being left out and wants to be involved in developing a list of goods?
Thank you. Another question? Oh, wait, you're thinking of your question. I'll. Yes. Come on.
Kim Andovich from Brookings. Do you see the actual subsidies to energy as opposed to the subsidies to panels and, you know, capital goods as part of the trade negotiations? Or do you see them outside that?
The subsidies to fossil fuels and stuff. Okay, very good. So let's go back to again, I'll turn to the minister. questions, and then and to the other panelists as well, in terms of the role of subsidies and the issue of is there even a greater need for subsidies given the direction that the price of natural gas is going. Question with respect to what is the frame of environmental goods and services. Did we just look at the goods as well as the broader pricing structures and subsidies to energy services? And then a couple of particular questions with respect to the content of EU-Canada trade agreements, the content of the APIC agreements, and the implications of that to where you could see yourselves going with an EU-US bilateral agreement. Minister.
Well, in the ideal world, we shouldn't have subsidies. That would be my point. But I think the problem is that the price of renewable energy actually, the price on fossil fuel doesn't reflect the environmental impact of fossil fuel. If you can get that into the calculation, I will bet any day that renewable energy will be cheaper than fossil fuel energy. So in a way, we actually have to frame that kind of picture, and that is why subsidies has to be in place for renewable energy in a starting phase. As we see it. In Denmark, we started in the 70s and 80s having subsidies for wind. Now we're actually at a where you could say it's actually they can manage a clear competition with other energy sources. But we also have regulations in place that saying that we want to have wind. We just made a new energy plan in Denmark saying that 50% of our electricity has to come from wind in 2020. And therefore, we are going to build two new offshore wind parks. And then we have decision by not only using subsidies, but making regulations for this, we are going to push fossil fuel into the dark zone, as you can say it. I know it's different places in the world. And then it's important to make a clear market. And that's why you have to have subsidies. But I would say it's only to get the industry up and running. Then it should actually be able to compete. The problem is that we have actually indirect subsidies often for natural gas and also for oil or coal, and I think that should be more transparent so you can get an even counting. Or when you're making calculations, you can very clearly see that it's not an equal field, that playing field. About EU-Canada, yes, it actually the free trade agreement is 75% finalized at the moment. I think we will finalize it during 2012. That is our ambition. We were hoping that we could have signed it during Danish presidency, but we still have some outstanding questions. And there is a green component of it. I can't remember the precise content of it, but I can come back with material if you want that. On APIC, I don't have any problem that APIC is developing a list on environmental goods. The European Union don't have any problem, but it's very important for us to emphasize that it has to be transparent. So we have to have, it has to be an open and transparent process so we see what is on the list and why is other things not on the list. And then it should also include, and I know some of the ASEAN countries is very interested in this, but it has to also have either the general specific preferences for the developing countries or other items where it's not excluding developing countries.
Josh, you want to
I just might pick up on the question about subsidies, because I think actually the point you made about certainly in the US context where natural gas prices are going is really a game changer, I think, in this country in so many ways, and certainly on the climate change front. Indeed, I mean, but one of the challenges has been that it is increasingly making renewable energy less and less competitive with natural gas, and utilities are certainly moving in the direction of using more and more of it. So it raises the question, well, what role for subsidies in this sort of context? And the Minister's, I think, made the point a couple of times, which I completely agree with, which is the fact that renewables do not compete on a level playing field with fossil energy. There's significant fossil fuel subsidies. The G20 is committed to remove them. There's been commitments in APEC and other fora. So that's something which needs to be addressed, obviously, when you think about, like, equalised cost of capital and how do you actually look at where the renewable energy can stand properly on its own two feet. But it does, I think, point to this subsidy question, which I think Kamal also raised, which is how does this play out in terms of also the WTO and the rules around that? And I think I'll just say briefly, I don't want to get into the subsidies agreement, but you can, you know, there's no prohibition on subsidies per se. I mean, the WTO agreement defines subsidies and it outlaws certain subsidies which have particularly sort of egregious, harmful impacts on international trade. And a good example, I think, is the current WTO dispute that the EU and Japan have taken against Canada, where really what Canada is doing is local content requirements as it tries to stimulate its own renewable energy sector. And the reason you don't want that, essentially, is because the domestic producers, investors in Canada do not have the choice of lowest cost suppliers. And so you lead to a more expensive renewable energy output in a say than would otherwise be the case. So if the goal here is not necessarily, and this is, I think, one of the really difficult issues in this space, which is separating out industrial policy from climate change goals. And if you want to get to climate change goals at sort of your least cost pathway, then you shouldn't be necessarily specifying local content requirements or specifying particular energy sources. You should be really setting goals and allowing the private sector to get there cheap as possible. The subsidies agreement at least tries to provide some disciplines which gets us in that direction.
Jennifer. And I'd only add on the subsidies front, I wouldn't disagree with any of that. I mean, again, the general prohibition is going to be if you trade in a product that you received a subsidy to help in the production of it, that's where you're going to run afoul of the WTO rules. Either if you've, again, if you've exported a product, the market into which you've exported it could potentially put countervailing duties on it. If it's a third country market, they're going to say if it has caused adverse effects to producers there, again, you're going to be subject to the disciplines of the WTO, which is, again, why at least I initially said, you know, one of the things that might be agreed upon is if you will, green lighting particular subsidies. But you would have to be very clear what those are and make it very clear that what they are not is subsidies to oil or gas or any of the indirect subsidies that you've been talking about. In the original sort of 1995 to 2000 period when, if you will, environmental subsidies were green-lighted, I mean, it was very specific that it had to be assistance to promote the adaptation of existing facilities to new environmental requirements. I mean, that was the text of the agreement. So, again, it was a very tailored carve-out, if you will, for subsidies. I don't see any reason why, on a going-forward basis, you couldn't come up with, again, a very targeted carve-out that says these subsidies, in order to address exactly what the minister has said, because the cost of carbon is not captured in the cost of fossil fuels, there's a global need to sort of rethink why you are allowing subsidies in this area and for what reason, and therefore you're clearly defining what subsidies would be green-lighted. And there's a clear basis for that I think would make sense within the world community for why you would create a green light for this particular kind and set of subsidies. And I don't think you would have to spend forever fighting over that definition. I mean, I think you could get there in some reasonable time frame in terms of an agreement that would allow everyone to provide subsidies as needed to help promote renewable energy.
And on this question of if there are various lists, if the APEC has a list of environmental goods and services and the EU, U.S. comes up with it, is that a problem or is that just what's going to be expected from having a number of different
Again, I don't think it's a problem other than sort of what then comes of it. I mean, obviously a lot of the fighting over the lists have been whether they are limited to goods that we would think of, you know, wind turbines and things that you would think of in the renewable energy area, or whether they bleed over into production process kind of
chemicals.
Goods where you say, if you made this ton of steel in a, you know, state-of-the-art electric arc mini mill furnace using only gas as your source of energy, and therefore this ton of steel is greener than this ton of steel that was made in a blast oxygen furnace using coal-powered plant, that's dirtier steel, then it gets trickier, I mean, from a trade rule perspective as to whether or not you're going to deem those to be a like product, and if they're like, then whether they're going to get treated differently. Then you will raise a whole series of issues. I'm not going to say that's not an appropriate road to go down, but if that's the road you're going down, those will be harder and longer negotiations that will be trickier to come to a final solution if you are going to try to go into the the energy source of the production of the good that then gets tagged to that good in terms of figuring out whether it's on or off a list will make a much harder agreement to reach.
Thank you. Any final questions before we conclude? Yes.
I just had a follow-up question to Ms. Hillman about that idea that you were just talking about. You probably, of course, know that the Chinese solar panel subsidies are a big issue right now, and a lot of solar panel makers here are concerned about that, and they've launched a CVD case. I wonder, I mean, does that complicate your argument at all that this would be a very easy thing to do? It seems like it would, given that this has been pretty controversial here in the United States.
I'm not sure the subsidy issue and the issue of the list of green goods are necessarily connected. In other words, I was saying that if the list of what would be considered an environmental good or service is limited to, again, the kinds of things that people think of as going directly into the production of renewable energy, I think that's a fairly easy, not easy, but I'm not going to say it's easy, but that's at least a concept that people
I'm looking
can,
forward to getting your help.
That's a concept that people can agree to. The debate that, like I said, that makes it more complicated is whether you're going to look at the production process that went into the production of the good itself, whether that matters in terms of whether it ends up on or off of a particular list. That, to me, is what I'm saying would make a much more complicated negotiation. The issue of subsidies, again, right now there is no green light for a subsidy. So the fact that the subsidy was granted for a green purpose or a subsidy was granted for a dirty purpose doesn't, at this point in time, make any difference under the subsidies agreement. So if the Chinese solar panels were produced using subsidies, and that there is a proof that Chinese solar panels have been exported to the United States that had a subsidy granted to them, and that subsidy has caused injury to the domestic producers of solar panels, then to me that is an appropriate. Then there will be a countervailing duty applied to those solar panels, and what China can do in the WTO is challenge whether or not the application of that countervailing duty did or did not meet the terms of the subsidies agreement. But I don't think it's changed by the fact that it was a subsidy for solar panels or not, because there's certainly nothing in the text right now that would allow subsidies in any one area and not in another.
Right. I guess I just meant, I wonder, not about the list, rather, I'm sorry, I should have been more clear, the green light approach for carving out subsidies, that's what I was asking about.
Okay, well, today it doesn't exist. I mean, so today there is no green light for any subsidies. So subsidies are all fall into the category of export subsidies, which are considered per se a violation of the agreement, and then domestic support subsidies, which, again, are subject to the disciplines under the countervailing duty law or the subsidies agreement if they're causing adverse effects. So if the Chinese subsidies fall into those categories, they would be treated as would all other subsidies.
One last question from the young lady here, and then we'll give a chance for the minister to reflect on the conversation.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Ella Chow from Brookings China Center. I want to ask about the opposite of subsidies, which is a price on carbon, as both of you have mentioned. So with a price on carbon more and more seemingly attainable as a source of revenue of consideration here in the States, and with China expanding its cap and trade domestically from 2 cities to 7 and more likely to expand even more, I'm wondering what are the international discussions on this and how to harmonize such a regime so that it doesn't affect the international competitiveness of export if a price of carbon is going to come into being in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Minister, would you like to take that one?
Yeah, I can take that one. Well, we have the discussion and the Kyoto Protocol, and we haven't really succeeded in getting the new term of Kyoto Protocol 2 in place, so that is actually the right place to have the discussion on carbon, and unfortunately, that is not moving forward at the moment, but it is actually what is needed as I see it. And can I just make a final comment on subsidies? Because I think in the CETA, which ICTSD has promoted, that is actually the division, as Jennifer was talking about, is it export subsidies for a sustainable energy, then it shouldn't be allowed. But when we're talking about domestic production, saying that internally in Denmark, for example, we want to support wave production, that could be the next step of technology as I see it, then there is, should be the possibility of doing that. But there's a very sometimes it can be difficult to see that that something is export subsidies and something is domestic production, but I think we have to use this kind of differentiation also when we talk about CETA. And also in CETA we are addressing that you cannot just give a certain company a subsidy, you have to make fair grounds for all companies. Finally, I just want to say it's actually it's an adventure sitting here, because it's coming from a country which doesn't have the huge tradition of think tanks. It's great coming to the US, having this very inspiring conversation and ideas. I've actually noted some of the ideas on my blog, going back and also taking that into our trade talks in the European Union and moving that forward. So thank you very much for your very inspiring interventions.
Well, thank you, Minister. I think that this has been a fabulous conversation. You've given us a number of messages. One, that there's urgency. I think that at least among the people that I work with here in Brookings and those in the climate community, we agree with that. And it's wonderful to hear that same urgency coming into the trade discussions as well from yourself and your panelists. We heard about new approaches. We heard about needing to think in innovative ways. And we've also heard that there may be some new momentum that will allow those new innovations and new approaches to take place. We heard a new vision, a two-part vision. One was to start thinking about broad and deep cooperation, transatlantic cooperation between the EU and the United States. And there appears to be some openings to that and some interest in that discussion. We heard that about moving that towards more plurilateral agreements, crowding in other actors, as well as not giving up on the multilateral side, seeing maybe these as stepstones too, but maybe that's difficult as well. We also heard to start thinking differently about some of the other actors in this frame. The China's position, India's position 10 years ago on these issues is changing dramatically as those countries are also changing their own position in the world's economy. We also have to think carefully and sensitively about the impact of these new strategies on the poorest countries, who have also great interest in having access to the new technologies, as well as not to be discriminated against. I think we've see a frame of action. I hope that you have a wonderful set of discussions here in the United States. I do want to ask the audience to thank you, but before we do that, I want to remind the audience that as part of the Green Growth series here at Brookings, we're going to be having a series of other discussions. May 2nd, next week, we're going to be talking about the Sustainable Development Goals and how those are being framed as part of the multilateral Millennium Development Goal conversation in the run-up to Rio Plus 20. On May 17th, my colleague Nate Hultman will be joined by others that worry about innovation strategies and thinking through what international cooperation to provide stronger support for research, development, and deployment of green technologies in developing countries might look like. And on May 24th, somewhat linked to this discussion, we'll be having a discussion on shipping and whether or not new strategies on mitigation of shipping, but also utilizing shipping as a way to create funding for things like the International Green Fund may be appropriate. So I hope you will all join us at those different events. With that, I want to thank the minister very much for taking time in her very busy schedule to join us. I want to thank our panelists, Jennifer in particular. It's a real pleasure to have you here, and I think you've given us some great ideas to also include into our research agenda. And Josh, as always, thank you very much for having put together this program, as well as for the research you do. With that, thank the minister, and thank you all for joining us this afternoon.